The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian B. Jemine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
No, absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is shit. This is a shithole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realise it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 9 of The Ausploitcast, the podcast where we take a deep dive into Australia's Ausploitation movement from the very beginning right up until today. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hey, hey. Good to be here. Good to be back and feeling good about talking about another 5 Ausploitation movies today.
Indeed, indeed. And we're going to get to the tail end of the 70s, Marcy, because we're covering 5 films that came out between 78 to 79. And in the next episode, after this one, we still have a couple of last few films that came out from 79, and then we start on our very first film from the 80s. So, yeah, we've already gone through a decade of Ausploitation cinema.
Yes, and as of this episode, once we actually talk about all these films, that will be 42 films we have covered so far for this show.
Indeed, and we still have plenty of more to come. which I'm definitely looking forward to, especially the 80s period, because I know a lot of great classics from this movement sort of came out during that period as well.
Yes.
But instead, though, we're going to be focusing on these 5 films, like I said, that came out from 78 to 79. But Marcy, we are not alone on this podcast.
No, we somehow talked someone into watching 5 films to prep for a podcast. I don't know how we keep getting guests on this podcast with so much movie homework and preparation, but kudos.
Indeed, indeed. However, what makes this guest a first for the show is that it's an international guest. So this is someone who lives here in Australia, as our previous guest has. However, though, this guest in particular is someone who has been on many episodes of our other podcasts in the past, and he's making his debut appearance on the Ausploitcast, and that, of course, is our good friend, Sam Inglis. Hello, Sam, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine, and really, 5 is not a problem. I'm prepping for a podcast at the moment where I've got about another 30 films to watch, so, you know. 5 is good.
See, Marcy, we shouldn't be complaining. If Sam has to do 30 films for a podcast, we only have to do 5 per episode.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But, you know, all 3 of us, we can binge watch a hell of a lot of movies in a short period of time, which is what I did to prep for this show.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. But before we get to the 5 films we're talking about tonight, since we have a lot of ground to cover, so we'll get to those shortly. But before we do, Sam, I have a very important question to ask you for anyone who is a first-time guest on this particular show, is what is your relationship with the Ausploitation movement? What is one of the earliest ones you remember seeing? And also, do you actually have a favorite from this movement?
I have to say, to my shame, I probably haven't seen enough to have a sort of definitive favorite, though I've seen, you know, plenty of very good films from this movement. There's still a lot outstanding that I really want to see, and hopefully we'll get to do another show so I can tick some more off. My relationship to it, like I would imagine a lot of international people, really began with Not Quite Hollywood, the documentary that Mark Hartley made about Ausploitation. I saw that at the cinema, and then I later picked up the, I think I have it on DVD rather than Blu-ray, but I later picked up the disc and grabbed myself a notebook, as is my wont with these documentaries on film movements, so that I could sit there and just make a watch list as I went. The earliest I saw, I'm just trying to think if there was anything before Not Quite Hollywood. I might have seen Road Games a little before. I saw Patrick fairly soon after, because that just looked really fucked up and interesting. But there's still a lot from that doc that I'm really looking forward to digging into. And actually, one of the films that we're talking about here, I think I probably saw before I saw Not Quite Hollywood. So I can let you know about that before we get into it, I guess.
Indeed. But we'll get straight to it with the first of our five films that we're going to be talking about tonight. And first up, of course, is the 1978 heist film, Money Movers.
Crap. Maybe. But what sort of security man can afford not to take it seriously?
You've always said you were the one person who could rob this place.
Yes, that's true.
Brian, your truck, our truck, will be the second last one in.
I got $2 million in that van. $2 million bucks, what the bloody matter? You've been around money too long, you're going off your head.
Looks like he couldn't find his way out of a light fog.
You've got a secret, haven't you? What is it?
You cut me in for a modest percentage, and I'll let the whole plan go ahead and give you some backup. How about that, Eric?
There's no safe in here. That's an alarm.
Trust is the name of the game, Brian.
Trust. Looks for your expensive video gears on the blink.
Did you send someone over straight away? It's our big day.
Look, I haven't got a secret. Well, maybe it's a secret of Darcy's.
We have one dissenting voice.
That's right. Listen, if we're chained to the money, it'll make it impossible for anyone to steal it.
Do you think I look like Faye Dunaway? Girls at work reckon I do.
Do something about that blood, Ernest. It'll run all over the carpet. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Bring in the nail clippers.
They say the counting house is impregnable, but someone has a plan to relieve it of $20 million. There's a plan to take it from him and one to stop him. The lucky ones only lose their toes.
Which was written and directed by Bruce Beresford, which is based on the novel The Money Movers by Devin Mitchin. And this film stars Terrence Donovan, Tony Bonner, Ed Devereaux, Charles Budd Tingwell, Brian Brown, and Lucky Grills. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, is an armored car company is the target of repeated heists. Company leadership is enforcing new measures in order to tighten security. The biggest danger of a new heist lies within the company's own ranks. Now, Marcy, we've already covered a couple of Bruce Beresford's films for the Ozboy cast, particularly with both the Barry McKenzie films. So how does this film, Money Movers, compare to those ones? Because it is quite the 180 compared to those ones.
Yeah, it really, really is. This is completely different from Barry McKenzie. They were quite comical and very silly. This is actually a very serious film. It is a raw and gritty crime heist film. Something I felt did a little bit of a disservice to this, and I'm not 100% sure, like, if this is on, if this has had like an upgrade disc or it's been cleaned up or anything. The version that they have on Prime Video, there's no closed captions, which for me is very annoying. And also, it just felt like when they were speaking, the dialogue was just so low at times. And when we had the action, it was very loud. So I think maybe I missed a few things because I couldn't hear the dialogue, and it is quite heavy on a lot of dialogue in the film. And without the closed captioning to try and understand, like, I feel like maybe if I saw this again with maybe a better audio track or closed captionings, I'd probably get a lot more or a bit more out of it, as I found this to be a really good and interesting film. Yeah, so this follows a few different characters and it weaves this story. We see the relationships between these characters and then actually what's going on. And a lot of this stuff is really interesting. It's intriguing and it's quite bloody and brutal. And that I was not expecting at all. So some of the violence, it was not that it was shocking. I just wasn't expecting to see that on that level. And yeah, I just felt like this was like a really good crime heist thriller.
So Sam, tell us your thoughts on Money Movers.
First of all, I should say that I don't believe this is available on Prime over here. So I watched it thanks to a link that Bede sent me in glorious 360p, which was the case for too many of these films. I suspect it looks rather better than the state that I saw it in. The thing that really struck me, like Marcy was saying, is the heist sequences are really, really strong. It starts off, you know, with a really good, intense little heist sequence before you really know what's going on, before it even bothers setting the characters up. So it sort of throws you into this internal investigation and you eventually develop a privileged viewpoint in that you know who the inside men are and things like that. While the characters don't, but initially you're not clued up on what's going on either. I think it's an interesting development of this privileged viewpoint that you get, and that sort of really involves you in a way that some of the character stuff was a little difficult for me. This might just be me, but there's a whole lot of sort of fairly weather-beaten middle-aged men who all look fairly similar and sound fairly similar, and picking out the individual characters at times was a little difficult for me. So that was a bit of a challenge because it is quite involved in terms of its plotting as well. But it's a really muscular little film, which I did not expect from the director of Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, for real.
I mean, to be fair, Beresford has had a very varied and weird career, it seems. He's made a lot of films in a lot of genres, and this one does look like something of an outlier among his filmography.
Yeah, it's definitely the most edgiest of the films he has made, for sure.
Yeah, and I think you can definitely tell that. I mean, particularly in the final heist sequence, which is really brutal and you know, fairly bloody and nasty. I think it's a really involving picture, actually, and, you know, managed to sort of get out over that barrier of, you know, first of all, sort of trying to pick through who's who exactly, and I'm sure that will work out more easily when I rewatch it, and I will. But also, you know, the 360p and sort of, you know, I'm miming. Yeah. Why am I miming on an audio medium?
Audio,
you know,
sort of
staring at the screen to try and work out what's happening at times, because the quality wasn't great. But yeah, really compelling. I like this one.
Yeah, well, I've heard about Money Movers for quite a while now because I'm very much familiar with Bruce Beresford's work. And I sort of was very curious about to see this one, being that this is a heist film. And, you know, again, like you say, Sam, his career, if you look at all of his films, is so all over the place. And I was just very curious to see how he would do with something like this. And I just assume, oh, it'll just be kind of a standard kind of heist film and that. And I watched that, and while it kind of is on certain levels, it definitely has that sort of more grit to it, which I was taken aback by. And the fact that a lot of the film's violence was very, very, like, didn't pull any punches at all. Mm. And which actually surprised me, because I would not expect, you know, Bruce Beresford to make something as violent as this. And also, like, like you both said, like, the heist sequences, particularly at the beginning and at the end, are very extremely well done, very tense, and just have this kind of belief, sort of this grounded feel to how they're approached, that they don't feel very showy or kind of stylized in any way. There's sort of a down and grittiness to it. It almost feels kind of like a William Friedkin film when you kind of watch those two heist scenes. I think the performances are all pretty solid, but I do agree, Sam, it did take me a little while to kind of get fully invested with the story, mainly because a lot of the actors, at least the ones who I'm unfamiliar with, did look exactly the same, and I was confused about who was who.
I'm right there with you too. It was hard to distinguish people at first. Mm. So it wasn't just you two. I was there as well.
The only person I know is Brian Brown, because Brian Brown is essentially Australian acting royalty, and of course you know who he is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This was one of his earliest film roles.
You can tell he looks young.
He's very young.
Exactly. But there are also some pretty well-known Australian character actors in this film, like Charles Bun Tingwell, who's like, again, another staple of Australian film and TV. And also, Marcy, I don't know if you remember the cop show Bluey. Lucky Grills is in this movie as well. So I was kind of like, oh, that's Bluey. It was interesting kind of seeing all these actors like in this film, but at the same time though, like I think as well made and as well acted as the film is, I think the only kind of major problems I had with the film was, of course, that was on a script level, mainly because it did take me a little while to kind of get into the film because, like, since there's so many characters that we're following and some of them do look exactly alike, I did get confused what was happening for at least half the movie until everything sort of started to click in as it went on. That being said, though, I think it's still a pretty solid little heist film that's got some great little sequences, some great acting. And also got to say, there's one little sequence in particular when the character of Eric Jackson, who's our main protagonist, who's like the guy within the... who's organizing the heist, he gets kidnapped by Charles Bud Tingwell's crew, and then he gets handcuffed, and there's this great little action set piece where he escapes still handcuffed, and he's like getting in these fights with so many people on the way out, and he's just doing it just with his hands tied behind his back. And I think that was like a really well done little sequence.
I agree with you. It was an intense scene as well. And if people don't know, you will know now, Terrence Donovan was on Neighbours as Doug Willis and the father of Jason Donovan.
Indeed.
Oh, yes. Right. Okay. So when I didn't realise he was in this, and when I saw him, I'm like, oh my God, it's Doug Willis, because I'm a Neighbours nerd and I'm so sad it's ending. But I thought he was great in this. I really liked him in that role. Kind of not, I don't know, because I can't remember seeing him in a lot of stuff because my memory is awful. But seeing him as in more of that like a villainous kind of role, bring it back a little bit. I was like, I don't like you, Eric Jackson. But sorry, I cut Sam off.
I think the sort of thing that maybe stops it from being great, this is a very good film, but the thing that kind of stops it from being great, I think, is... like we've said, it is a little hard to follow sometimes, and it doesn't necessarily need to be. Like, there's an interesting thread buried in there of a sort of cat and mouse between the guy who's recruited to find the inside man and the main character that could, if it were better developed and better told, could almost be a kind of Heat-esque storyline. Mm. Though different because they don't know who each other is, you know, and that I think could profitably have been developed a bit more, a bit better. And it's little considerations like that that keep this good rather than great, you know?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think if there was more focus on just that kind of central thing that was going on with the new guy coming in, and we then find out why he's really there, and between the Eric Jackson character. Yeah, but I think that there was just a few things that were a little bit all over the place and just kind of hard to follow at times. But, I was actually really, really impressed and enjoyed the film for the most part, indeed. I kind of was thinking, like, did Guy Ritchie watch this? Because this feels very Wrath of Man-esque.
I got that same feeling watching this film as well, Marcy. It definitely had that kind of feel to it. But I would even say, like I said before, like at times it just feels like a William Friedkin film, especially from this period, like The French Connection.
Yeah, it's like the Australian, The French Connection. You heard it here, folks. sex.
Exactly. If that's not an endorsement, I don't know what is. But actually, Marcy, before I just sort of noticed, I don't know if you noticed, because, you know, one of our favorite things about doing this show is seeing a lot of actors who we've seen many times before in this whole series pop up in roles in these films. The character of Dino, who was like the guy who works for Charles Bud Tingwell's character, he was like the main sort of criminal who would wear the mask and he had the shotgun.
Mm.
Remember him? Now, mm-hmm. if he looks familiar to you, Marcy, he was actually the lead in a film we have done on this show, The Cars That Ate Paris.
That is indeed correct.
And then I found out in my research, he also played Napoleon in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Excellent.
And I didn't even know this, and I'm like, okay, my mind's a bit blown right about now. But
yeah. Okay, that is something I'm putting away for Cinephile.
Yes. Yes. But I guess we can move right along. All right, I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion on Money Movers. Marcy, tell us your rating and final thoughts for this film.
Yeah, I give this one 3.5 being tied to a chair and trying to escape out of 5. If you are in Australia and you have Prime Video because it is available there, definitely check this one out. It's really good, and it's great to see these kind of films that are kind of a little bit more unknown that are from Australia and be, you know, very impressed and, yeah, discover something else. Like, I do want to actually sit and watch this again down the track. I just hope there's a better sounding version or there's some closed captions by that time, because that would be wonderful. But absolutely recommended from me. I really like this one.
And Sam, what is your rating and final thoughts for the film?
Yeah, I'm with Marcy on this. I went 3.5 out of 5. It's a really entertaining heist movie, you know, with a few frustrations. But again, some of them may be the transfer I watched and just my sort of unfamiliarity with some of these people. So, you know, that may be me as much as the film. Obviously, it's not available here. There is a certain library online where you may be able to find it, though.
Yeah, archive.org if people are interested to watch.
Oh, all right. I wasn't being that explicit. Yeah, it's on the Internet Archive.
Well, I guess my rating might be slightly lower than both of you guys. Mine would be about 3.5. Like I said, it's a very well-made film. The performances are all strong across the board. But like I said, I think if the script wasn't too confusing and if the story wasn't a little bit muddled, especially for the first half of it, I feel like I probably would have got a little bit more out of it. And this is, like, I could easily watch films without subtitles, but I think in this case, Marcy, I think the film probably would have benefited for me as well if there was, because I could figure out exactly what's going on in terms of the story.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, overall, it's a pretty solid little heist film. I would say if anyone's interested, definitely check it out for sure. Now we'll move along to our second film, which I know we'll all have a lot to talk about, and that, of course, is the 1978 sex documentary, The ABC of Love and Sex, Australia Style.
You all know about love and sex, but do you know all about love and sex? Now, for the first time ever on the motion picture screen, we bring you a really informative, revealing, and light-hearted look between the sheets at modern-day sex and love.
The ABC of Love and Sex, Australia Style. The frankest, most explicit film yet produced in this country. Just what is pornography? How many methods of contraception are there?
Nobody really knows all about sex and love, and our motion picture is not a blueprint for success. Merely an added supplement to other knowledge on the subject that you may acquire through books and in practice. Our film may not help you become an expert, but it just might increase your awareness.
If you love life, you'll love the ABC of Love and Sex, Australia Style. It's all about tenderness, warmth, sex, fun, love and affection. If this is what you're about too, perhaps we should get together.
Which was directed by John D. Lehman, written by John D. Lehman and Alan Finney, and narrated by Sandy Gore and Michael Cole. And the plot summary for this documentary is a tongue-in-cheek sex education documentary covering a different subject of each letter of the alphabet. Example, A is for anatomy, B is for babies, and etc. Now, Marcy, we have covered quite a lot of sex documentaries on the Ozboycast, and I can tell you right now, this is one of the very last ones that we'll be doing for the show. But tell us your thoughts on the ABC of Love and Sex, Australia Style, both as a film and how it compares to the other ones we've discussed in the past.
Yeah, I really don't want to watch any more of these, to be honest. Australia, what the heck were you doing in the 70s? Okay, so look, this is probably the least offensive one out of all the ones we've covered so far. And that's probably because it is the tamest one we have watched so far. This barely borderlines on softcore pornography, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But maybe he played it a bit too safe, because why wasn't A for ass or anal and B for boobs or something and C for cunt and D for dick, F for fuck? Like, no, this is,
But to be fair, most of those are covered in G for generals, Marcy.
Yeah, that's such a cop-out. It's, look, this is lame. This is really lame. It's also very weird because there is nothing really specific here to make it Australian style, I did not think at all. And I'm also sitting there thinking, so you're trying to be a little bit playful, but like hand out knowledge or something. But I'm sure like a lot of people actually probably knew a lot of this stuff, and it's not sexy, and I don't know who was getting aroused by this. I was probably a bit surprised that there are positive and progressive things about it, especially when you look at the time that it's from, because it takes things like female pleasure into consideration, and it does kind of, you know, have those discussions, and a lot of people still don't want to have those discussions now. But, for the most part, this is pretty tame, pretty lame, and kind of limp.
And Sam, your thoughts on the ABC of Love and Sex, Australia Style.
This is a fucking pile of shit. this is a terrible movie. I understand that in the 70s, and I mean, I'm baffled that even into the late 70s, but still, in the 70s, there were certain obscenity laws that meant, you know, if you shoved your sexploitation into a documentary form, you could get away with more. But first of all, aside from in H for Homosexuality, which shows a fairly full-on male-male kiss, which was a surprise and surprisingly progressive for the time, It's like, you know, A for Anatomy is right. Most of it just looks like a fucking anatomy textbook. It's no more explicit than that. So I don't see that they needed to have this format to have this kind of content out there. But also, of all the things I've ever seen that are deliberately trying to be sexy, this might be the least sexy.
Mm.
Dear God. I mean, It's so boringly clinical. So, I mean, yes, it discusses arousal and things like that, but it never even comes near provoking it.
No, I'm pretty sure everyone is dry watching this the whole time. To be more explicit than the documentary.
Yeah, And also, hilariously, it forgets to include V. It cops out on Z, of course, because, you know, all of these, and X, because all of these docs do, or all of the sort of ABC structured things that you see cop out on X and Z because it's difficult, and usually on Q as well. But it just seemingly, like, randomly forgets to include V, which is just bizarre and stupid.
Yeah, it forgot a lot of things, let me tell you.
But yeah, this is just terrible. I don't know who it's for. You know, the sort of the Dirty Mac crowd are going to be extremely disappointed, and nobody else is going to be interested or entertained. Thank God it's only a special feature on the Blu-ray I've got it on, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I gotta say, I think you both are a little too harsh on this movie. I actually didn't mind this movie, to be honest.
That's because you're the terrible Australian.
Well, yeah, but that's beside the point. But I think compared to the other sort of sex documentaries we have covered on this show, this is definitely one of the more, at least for me, one of the more stronger ones. The Love Epidemic, which we talked a couple of episodes back, is still the best one, but mainly because, you know, of that subject matter was a bit more interesting. But I think for
it
this-
was a lot more disgusting, I might add.
Well, that too. I mean, it did deal with sexually transmitted diseases and venereal diseases. But but I got to say, though, because I wasn't sure what to expect with this film. I kind of assumed, like, based on the previous ones we've done for this show, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, it's going to have some progressive things in it, but it's also going to have some backward things in it as well. But, you know, I can excuse that because of the time and place it was made and all that. But I'm going to say, though, like, I do agree in the sense, like, it's a very weird documentary because it's definitely going for that sort of more, even more educational feel, like an educational film with a lot more mixture of softcore and, on occasion, a hardcore sex involved. But I got to say, though, at least on the educational front, I actually found this surprisingly, like you say, Marcy, quite progressive in how it approaches all of its different subject matters. It doesn't approach it, like, there's definitely a bit of humor sprinkled throughout the film, which I will admit, did make me laugh, both intentionally and unintentionally, of course. Like, I will say this, though, I don't know what it is about these sex documentaries, but this film did this one as well. I don't ever want to see food involved with sex ever again. although I will admit the scene that it's used is actually played up for laughs, and it did make me laugh based on those, like, those two actors' facial expressions throughout that whole sequence. So that made me laugh there. But I think for most part, though, the film does an actually pretty good job at sort of going through each of its subjects, doing a pretty balanced job at explaining the importance of all these different things when it comes to sex, and also kind of saying, you know, these things are normal. There's nothing bad about these things. And, you know, these are just normal things that all grown-up people do when it comes to sex. I mean, yes, we all know that already, and of course the audience knows that already, but in ways, like you say, Marcy, on how it sort of approaches certain aspects is kind of very progressive of the time, especially in the late 70s. And the fact that it doesn't do it in a very sort of problematic or backward kind of way, I think was very interesting, at least.
I don't know that I entirely agree, because, like, even in its most progressive section, which is H for Homosexuality, it's also extremely backward and extremely stereotypical. You know, yeah, you've got that kiss, which just showing that in 78 to the degree that they do is very progressive in its way. But everything else in that sequence is a flaming stereotype.
It really is. I was about to say the same thing. I felt that was just so stereotyped, and I don't think it's... I don't know if they even thought about showing things that were not overly stereotypical. But I think it did get something really right where it said, like, female homosexuality seems to be far more accepted than male homosexuality. And I'm like, yeah, you can still feel that because you'll have a bunch of people who are like, ooh, lesbian sexy, but ooh, two men, bleh. It's like, just fucking get over it by now.
Oh, well, I should state for
that's
that.
That's me, just having a rant.
Yeah, I know, but I should say, just in terms of the gay party scene, and I'm looking this up in terms of trivia, all the dialogue in that scene was completely improvised by everyone involved in that scene. So I don't know, basically, I could definitely see your point, like, it does feel like that whole section is, of course, you know, full of gay stereotypes, but again, we don't know if that's just, like, how the filmmakers saw it or the actors brought to it, or if that is part of the gay community. So I can't really say for certain, like, which is which, but
I'm sure it's probably bits of all of those, to be entirely fair. There are, I imagine, I'm sure, people in the gay community who are like that, but just based on my gay friends, not all of them. And in that scene, there's not another type of gay person, you know. So
yeah, I think for that to have just probably been a much better bit, to just have seen a bit more variety rather than just presenting a stereotype. But yeah, like you said, I think that's probably one of the more progressive parts of it. But yeah, for me, I couldn't really, it did not hold my attention all that much.
Well, that's the thing though. Like this one compared to other ones where I'm like throughout of it, I was actually just intrigued on how it explored these topics. And
it
also
doesn't know anything about SEX.
Well, Marcy, that's beside the point.
That's
but
how
anyways,
he learns. He's got to watch these.
Yeah, exactly. But see, these are formal education even for me, Marcy.
Yeah, see, I'm on to you. I know why you liked it.
See, and also, you know, it's also an important lesson is like one of the most important things about sex is you, that you as the person, and this is what why is for you, is that at the end of the day, sex should always come down to you and what you enjoy, what you like and don't like. And if it makes you feel good, then, you know, keep on doing it. And I got to give the film a lot of credit for being at least very sex positive, like throughout this whole film and not like compared to the other ones we've discussed in the past, which feel, yeah, like I said, very backward or very judgmental in terms of how it explores sex. This is actually a very sort of positive film. And, you know, it, like I said, it doesn't take itself too seriously as well. But like, I do have big qualms against it, of course, is the actual sex scenes themselves, which basically, you know, kind of go back and forth between being softcore and hardcore. And it feels like, yeah, they're just in there to kind of titillate the pervs in the audience.
I don't know who was getting titillated.
Yeah, I mean, they don't.
Well, the 70s were a very different time in terms of sexuality. Let's admit that.
We saw a lot more in Phantasm and Phantasm Comes Again, and I didn't want to see all that.
Well, that is true. That is very true. But
look, I saw a hell of a lot more genitals in 5 minutes of Ceylon Kitty than I have seen in these five films, because there really is none of that in ABC of Sex.
Indeed, and somehow this movie is still better than Ceylon Kitty, but that's beside the point.
Ceylon Kitty got a high rating, so sorry to say.
Well, yeah. But I guess we'll wrap up our discussion on this documentary. but Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for the ABC of Love and Sex Australia Style? Because I've got to say that whole title.
Yes, my final thoughts are I give this 2 very dry everything out of 5. I don't really see a need for anyone to really watch it.
Sam, your thoughts and rating for this film?
This is, I would say, hot garbage, but it's not hot. No, this is just terrible. Half a star because it's not actively offensive, but otherwise, burn it. Burn it to the ground.
I'm going to give this 2.5 out of 5. And like I said before, I think as an educational tool, that's where the film works best in comparison than, say, as, you know, a film where it's basically just showing sex and stuff. Because when it does that, that's when the movie, I just check out. But when it gets to the more educational stuff, that's where I was more invested in. And also, like I said, compared to other ones that we have seen previously on this show, this is definitely one of the better made ones, and I was taken aback at first that this film opens and closes with a claymation sequence, which I did not expect when I put my DVD in for this movie. So but for me, I think it's definitely, like I said, it's one of the better ones. And like, if they took all the more the sex scenes out of it, I think this would actually be a pretty decent sex educational film, like if all the more hardcore stuff was taken out of the film. But that's just me, though. We'll move right along to our third film, which, of course, is the 1978 psychological horror film Long Weekend.
Listen to the sound of evil. It is out there, waiting.
Come side with us.
Powerful, deadly, invisible. They came to take a holiday.
Ta-da!
Now, they are running for their lives.
Where's the air?
Because something is out there. There are secrets. There are mysteries. There are forces beyond imagination. Challenge them, and every living creature, every blade of grass will turn against you. Prepare yourself for the fright of your life.
Christ!
Long weekend. An experience in terror and suspense.
Which was directed by Colin Eggleston, written by Everett DeRoach, who we've talked about previously on the last episode where he wrote Patrick. And this film stars John Hargreaves and Bryony Barretts. And the plot summary for this film is, when a suburban couple go camping for a weekend on a remote beach, they discover that nature isn't in an accommodating mood. Now, Marcy, I know this was your first time watching Long Weekend. Tell us your thoughts on this film.
Yeah, I guess I was saving watching this until we were covering it for the show, because this was, ever since I did see Not Quite Hollywood, I have wanted to see this one. And I think I kind of expected this to be a very, like, animals are fully attacking people kind of thing. But this isn't really about that. This is a bleak, and it is a slow burning, unsettling and uncomfortable ride of a film, because it's a descent into madness pretty much, with most of the film takes place at a location in the wilderness or outback, whatever you want to call it, where a married couple, Peter and Marsha, marriage is kind of falling apart. So this is sort of like a last-ditch effort to fix it. And Marsha doesn't really want to go because she's seeing someone else and wants to hang out with that person. So it's already very tense. And once they get to their location, it just gets more intense as they're arguing. And, you know, there's a few little things with the animals here and there, but it's just these two people who, you know, is all the stuff with the animals really happening, or is this just like a real representation of the hatred these two have between each other? Like, it is so, you don't want to see two people freaking argue for the whole film, but it's strangely compelling. And so the more uncomfortable it gets, the more you can't kind of look away, and you kind of do because it gets to that point. But I was wow. I was like, okay, this is a really, really solid, just very like psychological piece in the end. And the third act, and specifically John Hargreaves, his performance is just incredible. And it does have some very harrowing and shocking moments. In terms of things that I thought maybe didn't quite work, I don't know if it's just the way the character was written, or I'm not quite sure what it was, but I found Bryony Barretts as Marsha to be, I don't know, just kind of overly irritating, but didn't quite feel sincere in her performance, whereas I felt John Hargreaves was a lot more. I can see why there's a lot of you know, love for this film, and it gets talked about very highly when people speak about exploitation. I was very impressed.
Who would have thought, Marcy, that this movie would turn out as well as it is from the director of Phantasm Comes Again?
That is very true, because after watching Phantasm Comes Again, I never thought I'd come again. Back to this podcast. No innuendo, folks.
Indeed, indeed. But Sam, tell us your thoughts on Long Weekend. I believe this was also your first, was it your first time watch?
No. This was the film I was talking about earlier. This might have been the first Ozploitation film I saw. I saw this years and years ago. When the DVD came out in the UK. This is the film that M. Night Shyamalan was trying to make when he made The Happening, basically. It's like, if The Happening weren't shit, it would be this movie. And yeah, I agree with a lot of what Marcy said. I actually like both of the performances. I think any issues with them are in the writing and the direction, really, and we'll come to that. But I think they're extremely well performed, and you know, as much as the dynamic between the two performances can be intensely irritating, and on purpose, but
yeah, it is.
I think it is credible throughout. You know, these two people needling at each other and bringing the worst out in each other, and I think what's interesting about that is at a certain point, I think what's going on in the landscape starts feeding that a bit. And that's an interesting dynamic in terms of, you know, the film being about the landscape kind of turning against them. And I don't think it's because they're awful. I think it's because they're present. Is the impression that I get. They could have been anyone. And I think you see that in the other couple who are there briefly and then are not. I think Eggleston necessarily gets a lot out of the landscape. He makes it feel, despite being very open, initially at least, it's set on a deserted beach. So it's very open initially. He makes it feel very oppressive, particularly by the end, as you get into more wooded areas that are more sort of outwardly dangerous and enclosing and enveloping. I think the development of that visually is really interesting. So, and the moments of action, the sort of animal attacks are very intense. He maybe a couple of times leans on his visual metaphor a little hard. Particularly the shot of the rubbish leading up to the discovery of something I'm not going to talk about. I feel like that's, you know, sort of hitting you over the head with your metaphor a little bit. But, you know, I think he gets away with it. My issue with it is, do you remember seeing Open Water?
The
shark movie. I don't think I ever watched Open Water, to be honest.
Lucky you. Basically, I was on the shark side throughout that movie because I hated those people. I thought they were absolutely unbearable, and all I wanted from that movie was for them to get eaten. And there were moments where I definitely felt the same about this. It's like, these people are unbearable. Can this landscape hurry up and fucking kill them? And that comes through a little bit for me, but I think the craft of the film overcomes it eventually.
I can't remember exactly when I first heard of Long Weekend. I know I saw it way before Not Quite Hollywood, because I remember, actually, you know what, I do remember now that I think about it. I think I was reading when when Wolf Creek was coming out, there was an article in a movie magazine I was reading that was talking about sort of other Australian horror films that came out in the past. Like, some of them included ones I'd heard of before, like Razorback. But one of the ones, but when I sort of read the little brief wording on Long Weekend, I thought, okay, this sounds pretty interesting. It's kind of like Australia made like a killer animal movie. Okay. Well, that was my initial thought of what it was at the time. So I'll definitely check it out. And how I was able to watch this film, even though it wasn't available at my video shop, I was able through this kind of 1 month subscription with Big Pond Movies, and they actually sent the DVD out to me. So that was when I first watched the film. And like, even though it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be, like, say, you know, like an Aussie version of The Birds or something like that, what I just found really interesting, and I still do to this very day, in particular with this most recent rewatch of it, is how it's kind of this, of course, is this couple, and how them going through this sort of turmoil in this marriage while at the same time, this forces of nature are happening around them. But the thing is, though, like, you could easily say, like, oh, yeah, nature is out to get them and punish them. But at the same time, though, it has a bit more of a psychological feel. Is the emotions of their marriage breaking down sort of heightening all the things that are happening around them and with the animals or nature? And is it like all these little incidences that are happening, is it just because, oh, well, they just happen normally? But we're never really kind of sure. And I like that the film never fully explains whether it's actually deliberate that nature is trying to get even with this couple, or if it's just the couple's marriage and the sort of psychological turmoil it impacts on both of them. And I think both John Hargreaves and Bryony Barrett, even though, yes, I could definitely see like why a lot of people would watch this film and be completely irritated by their characters, since pretty much throughout the whole movie, they bicker and argue with each other. But I feel like their performances, at least for me, felt so genuine. And there were moments when they actually did have a little bit of happiness, kind of just reeled me in a little bit more. And of course, you know, like you say, Marcy, John Hargreaves, who we again talked about a few episodes back on Death Cheaters, he's got such a charisma to him as an actor. So even when he is playing a complete utter dickhead in this film in a couple of scenes, you can't help but still find him charismatic as well, because he just has that sort of aura about him. And I think Bryony Barrett, who, like we've talked about before, because she was like the first victim in Night of Fear, one of the back in on episode 2, I think she does a pretty good job here. But I kind of like would have seen like the strip kind of dive into more of their relationship. We do get hints of like what is going on between them as the story progresses, but I couldn't help but feel like maybe the film could have dived into it a little bit more. But that being said, though, I think Colin Eggleston does such a great job with his direction. He brings such a great atmosphere to this whole film. And like you say, Sam, he does a great job just using the area which this story is set to make it feel very claustrophobic and oppressive as you watch it. Even though, yes, it's in an open space, but you just can't help but feel that you feel like you're trapped. And that's probably why these two characters, particularly with Marcia, like they just want to get out there. Like they drop as they're trying to get away, they're driving through the bush and it just feels like they're going around in circles. I feel like those things are what make this film very interesting. And I think when I first watched it, I took it literally like, oh yeah, it's nature out to get them. But now the more times that I've seen this film, I'm definitely really like the fact that it's you're never really sure which it is going to be.
Yes, very, very much so. And I was going to say something and now I've completely lost it.
Like I say, I'm not as convinced as Bede of this sort of ambiguity. I see what you're saying and I see that the film is kind of going for it. I think, like I said, that the presence of that second couple kind of gives the game away a little bit.
Mm.
But, you know, it's still an interesting question of whether, you know, the extremity of what happens is like this idea of the toxic energy of their marriage kind of manifesting as well. Mm. I think that's interesting. But I feel like the film does have a viewpoint on it.
I can definitely say that. Add Marcy.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, certain bits in the beginning of the film, like, you just see how disrespectful John Hargreaves' character is to the nature around him. He has no care for that. And I think that's very metaphorical for how humans treat the planet. Like, this definitely has something to say about how people have been treating the planet for many, many years, and that, you know, one day Mother Nature is going to fight back, but fight back necessarily with the animals and stuff turning on us. I don't necessarily think so. But I think in the last few years, we have definitely seen that in different ways. But that's just kind of my opinion on that. So I think it very much kind of tells you. But I do see your point of view, because you do get that impression that are these people's, like, the essence of everything with the marriage breakdown, like, is that kind of inciting it as well? So I think it kind of lends to very, you know, you can have very different interpretations. And that's the beauty of cinema. I guess. Yeah.
I think what Marcy says about the view that it has on environmentalism and things like that as well is interesting in that it, you know, suggests that this is significantly ahead of its time, really. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I don't think the environmental movement had gathered significant steam, by the late 70s, really. This is definitely a film that has a message that feels not only very contemporary, but in a certain way, I wouldn't say prophetic, but, you know, sort of the moment now, because, you know, let's face it, through climate change, there are ways that we see our planet turning on us at this point and, becoming hostile to our presence in ways that are beginning to manifest and will probably get worse. You know, so it's an interesting film to watch through that lens these days, I think.
Yeah, and there's one thing I want to add. Towards the end of the film, and this is obviously a massive spoiler, if you haven't seen it, you've been warned now. But I just need to bring this up because I didn't like this at all. It really upset me. So towards the end of the film where John Hargreaves is in the van trying to get away and then he ends up out of the car because I think he's bogged or something, and the dog, Cricket, is left in the car with no way out, and John Hargreaves does not have a good ending. So I'm just thinking about that poor dog stuck in that van. And I'm kind of hoping that one of the other animals maybe rescued it or something.
It was that possum, Marcy.
I'm like, I don't like how you've just left this like that. That's not okay. Cricket was very endearing.
It was either the dugong or the possum that was going to save Cricket, Marcy. That's my theory.
Yeah, that's one of the other really in just disturbing visuals is that that dugong thing just keeps showing up even though it's been shot in the head. It's still following him like, how everything bad about you follows you metaphorically in life.
Indeed. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion on Long Weekend. Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, I give this one 4 Don't Leave the Dog in the Van out of 5. And, yeah, the other thing I wanted to add that I completely slipped my mind, part of the thing for me, at least, that made this very uneasy is the sound design. And
oh, yeah, and yeah.
It really gets to you, and I think that's so purposely done to make you feel very uncomfortable and uneasy. I do think it's a really well-made, acted, and, everything for kind of film. Like, I was very, very impressed and glad that I have finally seen Long Weekend.
And Sam, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, I mean, this was largely a terrific revisit. I think it's, a very interesting film now thematically. It's a really tense little thriller. It's very well made. Looks great. I'd love to see... Oh, actually, what am I saying? There is a proper Blu-ray over here. I just haven't got it yet. So definitely that would be recommended. 3.5, though, rather than 4, because, gosh, sometimes I just can't get past how much I hate the characters.
I'm going to be the same with Marcy. I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 as well. I think it's an incredibly effective sort of eco-horror film that definitely you could, like I said, you could find that could balance between, is it psychological? Is nature really out to get these people? So I think it finds that good line in between those and kind of offering, the audience their own interpretation of what is going on while diving deep in and exploring its many themes. But also it's got great performances. It's extremely well directed and good. And good thing you mentioned the sound design, Marty, because that's definitely one of the most unsettling aspects of this film is the sound design. So kudos for mentioning that.
Yeah, luckily I remembered.
And it's also beautifully shot by Vincent Momton, who we're going to be talking about again in the next film we're going to be talking about. So, overall, I think, Long Weekend is definitely one of the best of the Australian horror exploitation films. It's very sad that the film was a flop when it came out, but as time has shown, that the movie is now a bona fide classic. Now we'll move right along to our fourth film, which of course is the 1979 thriller Snapshot.
This is Angela. She used to be just like the girl next door. Now she's everyone's favorite snapshot. Who can she run to for help?
I don't know when to take you seriously.
It's a very serious matter, death.
I'm afraid I can't let you do that.
Can't let me?
Now perhaps one with the arm down a little, just a hint more breast.
Dear, sweet, innocent Angela.
But soon, she's not so innocent anymore.
How long did you have to lie on your back to earn more money than I get in 3 months? Right.
We were lovers.
We had two screws. Love had nothing to do with it.
From the decadent nightlife and the jet-set discos, Angela is playing a deadly game of hide-and-seek. And only one person can win. Snapshot is a conspiracy of terror. Why is she so frightened? Only she knows.
Which was the directorial debut of Simon Winsor. It was written by Chris DeRoche and Everett DeRoche again. And finally, and also, Chris DeRoche is also Everett's real-life wife as well. This film stars Sigrid Fortin, Chantal Kanturi, Robert Berning, Denise Drysdale, Vincent Gill, and someone who we mention a lot on this show, Marcy, Hugh Keysbird. And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a naive hairdresser is spurred by her vivacious friend into becoming a nude model, but soon discovers that everyone she knows wants a piece of her. Now, Marcy, I know Snapshot, or as it's also known in the US as The Day After Halloween, which clearly doesn't make any sense whatsoever. this is a first-time watch for you. Tell us your thoughts on Snapshot.
Yeah, I am almost, like, very stunned after having watched Snapshot that the director would go on to direct Free Willy, The Phantom, Operation Dumbo Drop, Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man, and one of my favorite, childhood type 80s films, Daryl. So
Daryl.
Daryl. Yes. So, whoa, okay. So, yeah, people who know me kind of well would know that I have a bizarre love for a stalker obsession type of movie. And you can hear all about that on one of our The Fanatic commentaries because we're obsessed with that movie. But yes, the first time I had heard about this was once again in Not Quite Hollywood. And I thought, this looks really interesting. And again, I was like, why did they rename it such a stupid thing? Like, it has nothing to do with Halloween whatsoever. Mm. But I guess, that's how they think they're going to make money from a film.
Yeah, well, pretty much it was, they gave it that title to capitalize on Halloween the year before. That's why only reason they gave it that title in the US.
Yeah, clearly. So I thought that, our lead character of Angela, played by Sigrid Thornton, who is pretty much royalty in Australia, was really just, she looks beautiful. And I thought she was very, very good in this role. Like, I felt like it was a very honest performance. And this is the kind of film about, it does take a look at that kind of fashion industry and being the young, naive person going into it. So you can think of maybe not as extreme as something like The Neon Demon, but So it definitely sets up like Angela, who, from being a hairdresser to then getting like a modeling job from her friend and her mother just being awful and kicking her out and all this stuff. Like, she thinks she's going into a better place, but then it's like everybody around her wants something from her. But it's made very clear that she's being stalked by who we think is just like an ex-boyfriend, but she barely dated this man who's stalking her. But I think it becomes very apparent there's more going on. And I think from like, and I won't really spoil the ending too much, but by the end, I feel like, yeah, okay, it's not really a surprise, but then it takes this bizarre twist and then another twist. And it's kind of like, I don't know what to make of all of that. But for the most part, I really enjoyed it. I felt like, yeah, most of the performances were really good. It sort of moves along at a very steady pace. It keeps you interested, and Angela is an interesting character, but you can see people are going to take advantage of her, and it's something that she's sort of not quite aware of. Snapshot was a very interesting film. Glad that it's another one that I've managed to see, and it's it kind of does have a bit of those Giallo inspired elements, and I'm just rambling on, so I'll let Sam take the floor now.
Sam, I know this was your first time watch as well of this film. Tell us your thoughts on Snapshot.
Yeah, well, first things first, I'm annoyed that I didn't realise that 88 Films have put this out on Blu-ray in the UK. I will definitely be picking that up at some point, so that should be a clue. Yeah, what Marcy was saying, I think the Giallo stylings are more in the story most of the time than they are in the visuals, though it definitely has some moments with the visuals. I mean, first of all, I really like the structure, which doesn't become apparent until the very end. But I think, you know, the opening is really super striking in the way that it uses sound in particular, I think, you know, is really interesting. And you don't even know how that relates to the rest of the film and for a long time. And I think that's really an interesting piece of structure. On the more general shape of the film, first of all, why haven't I seen Sigrid Thornton before? You know, she's beautiful, obviously, but I also really like her performance here. I think, you know, she gets the sort of balance of naivete and sort of wariness and awareness that she's that these people's motives are not all above board, but sort of being pulled along with it because she's flattered and at a certain point somewhat out of options. So I think that it's a good performance in a role that's maybe not especially easy to be good in, actually. Because it's not super developed beyond her sort of sticky relationship with her mother, who is, you know, very overprotective and overinvested in everything that she does, particularly this boyfriend. Now, the thing that I can't believe you didn't mention, Marcy, is how this ex stalks her, because it's one of the most memorable and weird images of the movie. In that she's constantly being followed by this Mr. Whippy van.
I was actually, as you started talking, I was thinking, shit, I didn't mention just how freaking, I'm creeped out by Mr. Whippy vans now. I don't want to see one. I don't want to hear one.
It's the second creepiest use of an ice cream van probably in a movie, aside from Assault on Precinct 13, obviously.
Yeah, no, that's very true, yeah.
Because that's fucking amazing. And if you haven't seen Assault on Precinct 13, sort that out.
Shame on you for not having seen it yet, honestly.
Yeah. So I like her performance. I think the other performances are maybe a little broad, though I did enjoy the broadness of, I don't have it to hand, but the actor who plays the photographer, who is like...
Hugh Keyes-Byrne, who plays Hugh Keyes-Byrne in Mad Max.
All right, cool. He's great in this. He's like always answering either three questions ahead or three questions behind of where you were. I think it's just really fun, the structure of his dialogue. He's very strange. And I like that it doesn't go the kind of obvious route with him, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's from the first scene that he appears in, I think there's a way that you expect his character to develop. And I like that the film resists that. I think it's interesting that it does. You know, particularly because he's not creepy in the way that he gets her to undress for the photo shoot. But the last thing I want to say is my favorite thing in this movie is by a distance. Oh, also the musical interludes are weird. But my favorite thing in this movie by a distance is the last sequence, which has Sigrid Thornton's character locked in a room papered almost entirely with a topless photo of herself, and then has one of the best full body burns I've seen in ages. And I love a full body burn, because in this age of CGI, you just don't get that anymore, and it looks amazing. So yeah, I had fun with this.
Yeah, well, I can say this because I was watching the credits. Marcy, you know who did that full body burn in the film? Grant Page, stuntman extraordinaire.
I was going to say, and Sam, if you want to see a full body burn and more Hughes Key burn and just craziness of whatever the hell the movie is, The Man from Hong Kong is the movie for you.
Oh, I need exactly. to see that anyway.
I got to say, like, I've seen Snapshot a couple of times now. The first time I watched it, I thought, it's okay. I kind of was expecting it to be more like a full-on horror film rather than a thriller. And so I was slightly disappointed by that, but at the same time, it still kept my interest. But the more times I have seen it, the more I've appreciated it. And I think what's interesting, though, about this film, like, even though, yeah, there is a stalker element in this film with the character of Angela being stalked by her Mr. Whippy Van driving ex-boyfriend, who he says he's 31 years old, but he looks like he's at least 50 in this film. But that's beside the point.
Hey, the 70s were hard, man.
Yeah, boy. He's what we would call on the 2B Tuesday a hard Canadian 31. But that being said, though, it's interesting because the stalker aspect is only a small part of the film. And that's what I think is really interesting about the whole story structure of the film. Like, there's so much different plot threads going on with Angela as she's sort of, you know, moving from being this hairdresser to becoming a model. Like, all these different characters and story threads that she gets a part of. And the stalker aspect plays only a small part of that. And it only really sort of kicks into gear in the last 20 minutes. And even then, that's when the movie kind of, I guess in a way, in a good way, kind of starts losing the plot, because there's so many twists and turns coming in that last 20 minutes. And I always kept thinking, like, Chris and Everett DeRoche were probably didn't know how they wanted to end this film. And they're like, oh, let's just do it this way. And it just ended up being a little, I guess, a little too crazy for its own good. But at the same time, that's what gives it a lot of fun as well. But I think overall, I think it's a pretty well-made film. I could definitely see the giallo influence while watching it, but I could also see maybe, like, it also at times did give me little shades of a Brian De Palma film as well in certain aspects. Like, if this film had Brian De Palma's, you know, stylized directing in it, I think it would just elevate it even more. But for what it is, though, I think Simon Windsor does a pretty solid job of his direction of this film. Like you say, Sam, that entire little sequence where Angela's in that room with all those topless pictures of her.
It's all the same picture. And that's
the same picture.
And that's what I think adds to just how kind of just creepy it is, because it's just that one freaking photo from the one magazine on the ceiling, on the floor, on the walls. It's very unsettling, but it's an insanely amazing visual.
Oh, yeah. And, like, there's so many beautiful shots throughout this whole film. And the score by Brian May. No, not Brian May from Queen.
I made that mistake. I was like, oh, Brian.
But Brian May, this Brian May is a staple of Ozploitation cinema, because he would score so many films from this movement. But I think his score is pretty solid as well. I think all the performances are great. And I think for me, because I forgot Hugh Keyes Byrne was in this film, Marcy, and having, you know, watched him, his performances in other films we've done for this show, like Stone or The Man from Hong Kong or Mad Dog Morgan, I was like, oh, he really has a lot of range as an actor in this film, because I would not recognize him if I knew if that was him.
Yeah. And he even looks very different as well. Not just like he can do such different performances that are just spot on. Like he looks different too.
Yeah. And mind you, we haven't even got to his iconic role as Toe Cutter from Mad Max yet for this show. So that kind of shows like how versatile of an actor he is based on all the films we've covered for this show. But of course, at the end of the day, it really is Sigrid Fortin's show. And what stuns me the most is like she was only literally cast in this film 2 days before they started shooting. And this is her first major leading role as well. And I thought she did such a spectacular job. And like you say, Marcy, I mean, we know Sigrid Fortin here in Australia is Aussie film and TV royalty. But kind of seeing her at this young age, when she was like 19 or 20, she had that spark. And she just is great throughout this whole film. And you feel so much for her character throughout all of it while she's going through all this stuff in the film. And particularly that scene that I just found a bit heartbreaking is when her bitch mother, played by Julia Blake from Patrick, comes in and is like just so horrible to her. And it's like, why is so many people, like her family and that, just so horrible to her? So, you know, and she just is so great throughout this whole film. And it really is her show at the end of the day. And I think that's also what, and also I really liked her relationship with the character of Madeline, played by Chantal Kanturi, who, again, name-dropping previous episodes, who was in Barry McKenzie Holds His Own and Alvin Rides Again. But this is her meatiest role in the Ausploitation movement yet. And I really, like, yeah, she's definitely plays her very sort of this kind of Joan's Colin-esque kind of performance. But she definitely is a lot of fun. And I did like her relationship with Angela because they're so polar opposites. But at the same time, you're never quite sure what her motives are to getting Angela to become a model is. And I think
it was to get closer to Angela because she was in love with her.
Yeah, pretty much, yes. But overall, I think it's just a really solid film that the more times I watch it, it just seems to get better and better.
Yes, I was surprised. I really enjoyed it. I thought it actually just flowed really well. Like, I was definitely very intrigued. But yeah, I kind of like guessed maybe what was happening, but then it kind of just like switches this whole thing. I'm like, wait, what? So it's like this one to the other, a little bit kind of muddled. But yeah, it's a very, very damn solid film.
For sure.
Yeah, I don't know what else I can say about it, to be honest. It's a really good-looking film.
Again, by Vince Monten, who also shot Long Weekend as well.
Yeah, definitely pick this one up on Blu-ray.
Oh, for sure, yes. And the Blu-ray I recently picked up, I believe, was a 4K transfer of the film, and it looks spectacular. Well, I guess that could be a wrap on Snapshot. Marcy, any final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, I give this one 3.5 creepy Mr. Whippy Vans out of 5. it's a very solid film. It's a really good little Ausploitation film. And just ignore that alternate title that makes no freaking sense. Sigrid Thornton is great. I think, the whole cast is. And, I think the film comes together really, really well, despite a few little issues here and there. So highly recommended, and check it out on Blu-ray.
And, Sam, what are your final thoughts and rating for Snapshot?
Yeah, I went with a 3.5 on this, but I've got to say it's sort of growing a little bit in my estimation, and I can see that going up when I'm able to see the Blu-ray and, you know, watch it properly, because, again, this was one that I saw in all the glory of 360p on YouTube. You know, I don't like doing that, but, you know, I had to watch it for the show, and I didn't realize it had come out, so you know, there it is. And, you know, it's still full price as well, so I probably wouldn't have. But, you know, I will definitely pick it up now, and I would recommend that people track it down. It's well worth a look. Yeah, so I could see this going to a 4, but for now, 3.5.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way as you do, Sam.
I give this about 3.5 as well, so we're all giving the same rating to this film. Like I said before, I think it's a pretty solid little thriller that kind of, like, yeah, you can definitely see where some of the plot is going to go, but it does offer some surprises every now and again, particularly with its insane last 15 minutes. But for me, at the end of the day, it really is Sigrid Fortin's show. She's fantastic in it. And you can definitely see in this film why she would become a huge staple in Australian film and TV. She's just so great in this film. And unfortunately, though, like I said, like Long Weekend, this film didn't do that well when it came out at the Australian box office, which is a shame, because if it did, this film would have done to Mr. Whippy Vans like Jaws did for The Beach. Like, it would have been everyone terrified of Mr. Whippy Vans.
I'm now terrified of Mr. Whippy Vans, so.
Which, you know, probably wouldn't have been a bad thing.
But we'll move right along to our fifth and final film for this episode. And I know this is a film that all of us have watched for the first time for this show. And that, of course, is the 1979 drama The Last of the Knucklemen.
The Last of the Knucklemen. Tim Burstall's new motion picture, The Last of the Knucklemen.
Which was written and directed by a man who keeps popping up on this show, Marcy, Tim Burstall, which is, of course, is based on the play of the same name by John Power. And this film stars Gerald Kennedy, Michael Preston, Peter Hira, Dennis Miller, Michael Caton, Steve Rackman, Michael Duffield, and Steve Bisley. And the plot summary, which I am reading off Letterboxd this time, is, in the tradition of Sunday Too Far Away, this independent film is based on the classic Australian play by John Power. The film tells the story of a group of miners living in the camp in outback Australia. They swear, brawl, gamble, and drink heavily. Central to the story is the conflict between Tarzan, the group leader, and the cocky loudmouth, wisecracking pansy. The result is a bare-knuckle punch-up for the movie's denouement. I probably said that word wrong, so please forgive me. but Marcy, tell us your thoughts on The Last of the Knucklemen, and how does this film compare to other Tim Burstall films we've covered for this show?
Yeah, so if I look at my Letterboxd, my most watched director for the last 2 years is Tim Burstall. so we have watched quite a few of his films. And yeah, for the most part, both of us have actually really enjoyed them. So I kind of just went into this. I didn't really read a plot or anything because I like to just, you know, head into a movie, no preconcerned notions, nothing like that. So yeah, I didn't know this was based on a play. And as it unfolds, absolutely, it was based on a play. And this really is about the relationships with the crew that are on like this mine in the outback. And pretty much sort of the story picks up when we sort of get two new workers and how they fit into the already established dynamic that's there. And then you have sort of the conflicts between Pansy and the boss is Tarzan, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So everyone has these silly nicknames. So you have, you've got all this stuff going on, and a lot of this film is really driven by being in kind of the same location, and it's driven by the characters and the dialogue. And it's really interesting. It's really compelling. And they engage in some poker games. And by the end, it is some of the most intense stuff. It really is. Like, this thing gets intense. And it's just crazy how something so simple is just so intense. And I felt like the characters felt very honest. Like, these felt like representations of different kinds of people. Like, you could see yourself knowing these kinds of people. So that felt very, very natural. And while I didn't necessarily find them all very likable, I thought like the character that they called Methuselah, played by Michael Duffield, was just really endearing. And I just found him to be one of the more compelling characters. And, you know, he's kind of the old man and he doesn't take himself seriously, but everyone kind of looks, you know, down on him in a way. And I was actually very surprised because I didn't know Michael Caton was in this and people will remember him.
Oh, yeah.
As the dad from the castle. Steve Bisley in this once again. And, you know, his character is actually dealing with like PTSD. He was probably, I'm not sure if it mentioned it in the movie because I can't remember, but I would assume he was a war veteran at some point, having a disability. All the characters are very different. You can tell these people apart from how they act and talk. And it was just, I found it a really just engrossing and interesting little film. And it really tackles a lot of toxic masculinity. And, you know, this is a film from 1975 that kind of has a bit to say about that. We're in 2022, not a fuckload has changed. So I think there's a lot of work to do on the toxic masculinity front. But I really enjoyed this film, and it's the kind of quality and something that's quite intriguing that we've come to know from Tim Burstall films in the 70s so far.
Indeed, and I was sort of looking up to see how many of Tim Burstall's films we've covered for this show, and this is our sixth one we've covered for the show. And also, it's produced a whole bunch of other films as well that we've covered as well. So, but Sam, tell us your thoughts on The Last of the Knucklemen.
First of all, that is a title. That is a hell of a good title. Again, I agree with a lot of what Marcy's saying. I think you can definitely tell that it's based on a play, but I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't mean that it feels static at all. Yes, there are a lot of sequences that are set in a single space for a fairly extended amount of time, particularly those poker games, and one in particular that I'll get to. It's never a film that feels trapped by its stage origins. The camera is always motivated, whether it's moving or static. It makes an effort to differentiate between outside and inside set sequences so that you're never like stuck in a single space for too long, except in the fact that, you know, it only alternates between the outside of these living quarters and the inside of them. And that's a really key thing for, you know, how the characters interact. It's another film like Long Weekend that I think really exploits the possibilities of taking this wide open space like the outback and making it oppressive and making it claustrophobic, because these characters so seldom get to leave it and are always stuck in this insular group where I think there's about 8 or 9 of them overall, that they're always together. You know, that boils over in a lot of different ways, violent and comedic sometimes as well. You know, a lot of sort of good-natured ribbing goes on between them. I mean, I'm sort of amazed that the character called Pansy actually allowed them to call him Pansy, but you know, everyone's got, you know, their nicknames. One of the new characters who comes in, they discover that he used to live in a monastery, so he obviously becomes monk, which he doesn't like to begin with, but eventually, you know, basically embraces and lives with, because that's the dynamic of these characters. The other thing I think you were very right about, Marcy, is I think it's incredibly well written. In that I said early on about Money Movers that a lot of the characters kind of sound the same, and I think a lot of the confusion that we all felt a little bit around the plot of that film is that the dialogue often sounds as if it could be given to any of the characters in that. You don't have that with this. You know, all of the characters are very well, their dialogue is very individual. They all have a very specific voice. And I think the performances match that all round. I obviously don't know these actors. The Australian film industry in a lot of ways is as insular as this group of people. And so I haven't been able to absorb these guys and discover their filmographies in the same way as you have. But I think they're all terrific here. It's a really, really an interesting and entertaining movie, but I think it really reaches its apex in that major set piece at the poker game, where Methuselah and Pansy are playing and the stakes keep going up and up and up. And I, you know, there's a moment where you just sort of feel your chest tightening in there, and there's nothing happening other than this betting. You know, the camera is very still and the cutting is very regimented at this point, and but it's all just this hothouse of tension, and it's really a great example of simple technique being effective, that sequence. I think this is really, really strong.
I got to make a clarification. I said there was about 6 movies of Tim Burstall's were done. Technically, actually, it's 7.
Yes, it's like, he directed a part in Libido, hence why I have watched 7 Tim Burstall films in the past 2 years.
Indeed. But for me personally, this is, of course, a first-time watch for me as well. I guess what drew me into this film was, of course, like you say, Sam, the title, because that is one hell of a title for a movie that, if you saw that title anywhere, it's immediately going to catch your attention. Like, oh, this sounds very interesting. But I went into it, like, not knowing what to expect. Like you, Marcy, I didn't really read up too much about the film, and, like, I didn't know who was in it or what it was about. Like, I knew Tim Burstall wrote and directed it, and that was pretty much mainly it. And so when I went into it, I was, like, pleasantly surprised that a young Michael Caton is in this film.
Yeah.
Because that was completely unexpected. Although, Gerald Kennedy, of course, was, we talked about in our previous episode, Raw Deal, because he was the lead in mm-hmm. that. So it was great seeing him in this film. And also Steve Bisley being in this as well. But like you both have said, the performances from everyone are so fantastic. Like, everyone gives top-notch work for their role, and they all bring such individuality to all of their characters that make them all feel very distinct. And they're nothing alike at all. And I think every one of them does such a great job. And Michael Preston, who plays Pansy, I found him such a magnetic on-screen presence from the very beginning to the end. I just couldn't take my eyes off him because of his character and his performance. Like, he is just so good every time he's on screen. And of course, Michael Duffield, who plays Methuselah, he's also fantastic in this film as well. But that's the thing, though. Like, every performance is so good. And being that it's a film that does a good job at not feeling like a play, like, even though most of the film is kind of set in their little shack where they all sleep and gamble together, but, you know, it doesn't feel that sort of stagey feeling at all. And the film actually finds really interesting ways on how to direct those scenes so they don't feel that at all. And of course, you know, being that it's set in the outback, like, it gives the film that sort of even more of that isolating feel as well.
Yeah,
like And the film.
I was going to say that as well. Like, you both touched on the kind of isolating feel, and it's like, yeah, very much. And it's almost, you know, if you think about just being kind of isolated with, say, the same, like, 5 to 8 people, like, you could see tensions boiling over pretty quickly. And some of us who maybe did not do long periods of lockdown by ourselves probably felt a bit of that if you watched this movie. But I will let you continue. I feel bad anytime.
That's all right. But like you say, Marcy, I think, like, being that this is a film that kind of touches on what we know now as toxic masculinity is what makes it very fascinating of a film to me, just seeing how these men relate to each other and what they do when they're hanging around each other. And of course, particularly with the sort of the rivalry between Tarzan and Pansy, like, how much these two characters just despise each other. And you're just waiting for, at some point, that there is for that fight between them to happen. And also, like, it's very well written. There's so much great dialogue throughout this whole film. And also the gambling sequences, particularly the one you mentioned, Sam, are so well done. And particularly that one, especially, is you just feel the intensity of that moment. And it's just really well done. And it's kind of interesting, Marcy, kind of seeing all these films from Tim Burstall from when we first watched Stalk in in the years in 1971 in that second episode till now, like 8 years later, we've seen him grow so much as a filmmaker, kind of starting off making all these kind of orca kind of sex comedies right up to making something as interesting and thought-provoking as something like this, or even M-Play, which we talked about in a previous episode. Like, it's interesting kind of seeing how he sort of evolved as a filmmaker. And this is definitely up there as one of his best works for sure. And it's just really good stuff. And I guess some could make the argument whether it could technically be an exploitation film or not. But I think there are still elements in it that definitely give it that edge. But I could definitely see, like, some people could easily just more classify it as an Australian New Wave film rather than an exploitation film.
Yeah, I might be one of those people because, I mean, I looked at this and I was like, I watched this early in the run of stuff that I was watching for the show. And, you know, you didn't give me an order, so I just went with whatever I felt like. And, yeah, it definitely just felt more like a straight drama. The fight sequences maybe lean it into exploitation a little bit, but, you know, it's very much a play adaptation and a straight drama to me. But I'm really glad I've seen it.
And also, Marcy, I just sort of realised Denise Drysdale, who had a small part in Snapshot, is also in this movie as well.
Yeah, I completely forgot to mention Denise Drysdale being in movies. I was like, wait a minute, what?
I know, it's weird. And of course, even though you're not familiar with Denise Drysdale, Sam, she, of course, is Australian film and TV royalty, or mainly more on the TV side of things. So it's kind of weird just seeing her pop up in both these movies back to back.
I've got a lot of names I need to look into.
But I guess if you're interested to see other Tim Burstall films, like, his filmography is very kind of all over the place in quality. I would say there are two in particular you need to watch if you're interested to see more of his work. I would say N-Play and also Peterson, for sure. And Stalk as well. Those are probably the three best ones to go to. I guess that could be a wrap on this fifth and final film for the episode. Marcy, tell us your thoughts and rating on The Last of the Knucklemen.
Yeah, this is definitely one that should be seen. It's quite a surprising one. And yeah, it is kind of debatable whether you could look at it as, you know, a straight sort of exploitation film. But I think perhaps the low budget nature of it and that kind of stuff maybe lends it to it a little bit more being, yeah, like an R-rated film as well. But yeah, like, I was really impressed by this. It's just a really, really just good damn film. And yeah, I think, Tim Burstall's had a very interesting filmography. And this is just another one of those really, really good films that we've seen from Tim Burstall, which I'd put alongside like Stalk, Peterson, and
what's the
other one? End Play. Yeah, just, yeah, really, it was really intriguing. I was definitely invested the whole time. And, yeah, it was very easy to follow because, as you've said, like, these are very distinct characters in everything. And, yeah, just an interesting a little bit of, an Australian drama. And, yes, I give it 4 out of 5 intense games of poker with Methuselah.
And, Sam, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
So of the stuff that I hadn't seen before that we watched for this show, I enjoyed Money Movers. Money Movers is really entertaining. Snapshot is something that has some great sequences and that I'm looking forward to seeing in proper format. This feels like a real discovery and easily my favorite thing that we watched for this. Just really strong performances, a really great script. Against the odds, even aside from the horror film, like the tensest movie that we watched for this as well. I really hope that somebody digs this up. You know, it's the kind of thing that I could see like Eureka or Arrow, even 88 maybe less so. But, somebody like that picking up, doing a real good cleanup job on and putting out with some contextualizing extras. I think that would be really valuable. More people ought to see this. It's terrific. 4 out of 5 on this.
I'm going to give it the same rating as both of you. I'm giving it 4 out of 5 as well. I think End Play is still probably my favorite Tim Burstall film, but this is definitely a very close second. I think it's very well written, extremely well acted, but just across the board, like everyone in this film is just great. There's not a bad performance among the bunch. And it's a film that definitely kind of transcends its stage origins. Like, you could definitely see the hint of that in how it's directed, but it feels more than a stage play. And I think Tim Burstall, as a filmmaker, really finds interesting ways to kind of elevate it so it doesn't feel stagey at all. And it's just a really compelling film that kind of looks at, you know, like a very early example of looking at toxic masculinity as well. Yeah, so I guess that could be a wrap on this episode of the Ozploitcast. Thank you, Marcy, for always being an awesome co-host and putting up with all the movies I force you to watch for this show.
That's all okay. I enjoyed very much 4 out of 5 of these films, so that was a pretty good run this episode.
Indeed, indeed. And thank you, Sam, for coming on the show and talking about these films with us and also getting into a bit of a deep dive into kind of the more unexplored areas of Ozploitation cinema.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, I hope we can do it again. There's been some really good films on this episode, so, you know, I'm up for another one.
Definitely. Well, we'll definitely have you back for sure. Well, you're always welcome to come back anytime, so. And I know we have you on for another episode of Ozploitcast very soon. Actually, you'll be back next month, according to my list here.
oh, crap. Well, I hope this went well then for everyone listening.
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did. But this was a very fun episode of the Ozploitcast, and I hope all of our listeners enjoyed us discussing all these films. And before we wrap up and finish up for the night, Marcy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Yes, people can find us at supermarcy.com. That's supermarcey.com. And everything is there. You can find all the links in the show notes. You can find the Super Network on your social medias. And if you look up the Ozploitcast in your podcast player, you should be able to find us to subscribe. And of course, you can give us a rating and review if you're enjoying yourself. Even if you're not, we'd like to hear why not. And you can find me personally on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. And you can check me out on Letterboxd. And I keep a list of all the films we've covered for this podcast on my Letterboxd, and that is super_Marcy. Yes.
And Sam, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Yeah, on Twitter, I'm at 24FPS UK. You can also find me on 24FPS UK on Letterboxd if you want to, you know, sort of keep tabs on what I'm watching, though I do little tweet reviews, so that's probably the best way to keep tabs on viewing and thoughts on movies. Otherwise, you'll find my links from Twitter, and I also do some writing for Hey You Guys in the UK. My latest review over there at the moment is for the Norwegian disaster movie The Burning Sea, which is the follow-up to The Wave and The Quake. So,
now, yeah. I haven't seen The Wave or The Quake yet, and I know those two first films deal with the same family, are the same family in The Burning Sea.
No, which is kind of a shame because I love Christopher Yoner. He's a brilliant, brilliant actor, but this has just as good a leading performance.
That's good to hear, but I'm a little disappointed because I want to be like see that family. Like, how could another disaster happen to us for the third time in a row?
I did mention that it's a bit of a shame because he, you know, on a third he would have sort of become John McClane, but it's natural disasters rather than terrorists that keep trying to kill him.
See, there's a missed opportunity right there. But if people were to find me personally, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/bjermine, and where I will be teaching my version of the ABCs of love and sex, but that's a whole different story right there. and you can also find me at my Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/bjermine, or my And also find all my work over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns.
Indeed. And coming up for episode 10, which Sam, I do believe you will be joining us, we will be covering and looking at the films Thirst, Mad Max, Felicity, The Plumber, and The Chain Reaction.
Indeed. And we're finally tackling the granddaddy of the exploitation genre with Mad Max. So I'm very excited to revisit that film for the show.
Can I just say, this will be my first viewing of Mad Max.
What?
Damn,
well,
boy.
Well, our listeners are definitely going to have to tune in for
you that absolutely episode. Have to join us, because that is going to be your first viewing of Mad Max.
There so. We go.
Well, I think it's pretty much settled.
Yeah, and I have a copy of Felicity on Blu-ray coming in the mail. I'm very keen to, yeah, check all those movies out. And, yeah.
Yes.
Awesome time.
But, yeah, so I guess all of our listeners will have to stay tuned for that one next month. And we'll see you all then, everyone. See you, everybody. Bye.
Dingo Ate My Movie is a podcast that celebrates Australian films from the 70s, 80s and beyond. From 70s and 80s classics such as The Man from Hong Kong, Razorback and Mad Max, to the more recent fare like Body Melt, The Loved Ones and later this year Wolf Creek and Undead, there's something in there for everyone. Join us each month for a deep dive into the movies you may know well and others that might have flown under your radar. You'll find our episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app. Or check us out at dingomoviepod.com.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark, do 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 do. Surfy shark, do 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 do. And now back to the show.